Hi, I'm Frida Vaisel, and this is Radically Human. It's been a while since I've done one of these episodes, and it'll probably be a while before I can do this regularly again. Things in New York have been really difficult for those of us who've not been complying with vaccine mandates. We've been unable to participate in many aspects of life, and I've been busy preparing for the possible eventuality of needing to leave in the event that it becomes unsustainable to stay in this city that continues very comfortably to accept this so-called new normal, this very depressing new normal. So today, I wanted to share with you something that was actually recorded many months ago. It's another episode with Simon Elmer that I had done in the summer of 2021 that I never got around to finishing and putting up. And we talked there about the dark winter ahead, and I thought it was relevant now. So here's my conversation with Simon Elmer from Architects for Social Housing, who's been a really stellar voice throughout this entire pandemic, and it's been my great pleasure to talk to him.
Thank you so much. Very much appreciate it.
You're welcome, Frida. Thanks for having me back on.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to talk about some different things. I also thought it was an opportunity to step back and talk a little bit about your work in general, because I've been reading your archives going back quite a while. I think it'd be good to start with just a sense of what your philosophies in general are. I'm going to frame the question more specifically. So before 2020, when you started to write very powerfully about the lockdown and the biosecurity state in the UK, you were writing about other things on ASH, Architect for Social Housing. And obviously you were a lecturer. So maybe we can start with you introducing yourself. Who are you? Where do you live? What is ASH about and what drives you in writing and in that work?
My name is Simon Elmer. I'm the co-founder and director of a community interest company, we call it in the UK, which is called Architects for Social Housing, or ASH. My partner and I both live in central London, and there's a program going on in UK housing, what has been called the Estate Regeneration Program. This program, there's nothing regenerative about it, it's a demolishing one. It's about freeing up very, very valuable land in the centre of London and privatising that land, handing it over to developers who are looking for places to invest their money. We got invited into these council estates. We live on one ourselves. That's one of the reasons. And we realised that there were ways in which we could challenge the arguments being made of why these homes would be demolished. We're about to publish a report. Well, it's not just the report. A council estate that we've been working with for the last 2 years up in northwest London. It's got about 4,000 people, and their estate is under threat of being completely demolished and redeveloped. And we've been working with them, trying to make them aware of what the consequences are of them voting for the demolition of their homes, and also developing with a team of, I know, about a dozen other architects, engineers, quantity surveyors, et cetera, to produce a design alternative for this, which is financially viable, socially beneficial, environmentally sustainable as well. So we're about to publish that next month, and that's kind of the focus of what we do. But as you've said, over the last 15 months, I've been drawn, not exclusively, but primarily a way to, I guess, applying the same sort of skills that I developed in analyzing and writing about the causes of the crisis of housing affordability, and applying those to try and understand what's been going on under the cloak of this coronavirus crisis.
So you mentioned the lie. You want to summarize how you would describe this appalling last 15 months?
That's a big one.
Is it too hard?
Okay, let's have a look. There's so much, isn't it? But let's just look at one thing. One of the articles I wrote, what was it? I think it was beginning of this year or something. It's called Manufacturing the Crisis. And I looked very closely at the figures on deaths. So I looked at overall mortality. I looked at infection fatality rates. I compared them to previous years. The number of excess deaths in the UK from the usual and primary causes of death in the UK, like cancer, heart disease, dementia, etc. And they have gone up immensely. They've gone up enormously. Last year in 2020, about 80,000 deaths attributed in the UK to COVID-19. I think we all know by now, to have that attribution to be defined and recorded and disseminated as a COVID-19 death, the criteria for that are they're not laughable because unfortunately they're very serious, but they simply, you know, they have no medical basis whatsoever and they are a deliberate fraud. But what I think isn't so well known, although it's beginning to become emergent now, is the number of people who died because of the withdrawal of medical treatment, or medical care, and medical diagnosis as well, which is immense. The lack of diagnosis of cancer and so on and so forth. And I mean, in a really conservative estimate, I would say at least half of those 80,000 deaths are misattributions of deaths of people who died of heart disease, of undiagnosed cancer, of dementia in particular, because elderly people, care homes, there was at least sort of 20, 30,000 people who died in a very short period. Elderly people in care homes, where 70% of people suffer from dementia, who died in a very short period of time under appalling conditions and were simply swept under the COVID-19 carpet. So before we get to all the kind of, you know, the loss of liberties, the appalling things that are being done behind this, the privatizations, the erasure of our rights and all that, the people responsible for this have committed crimes against humanity. They are responsible for the deaths of, in the UK, maybe 50, 60, maybe 70, maybe 80,000 people who would be alive if lockdown, which, as we know, has no medical justification or precedent in modern medical history, hadn't been imposed. So that's, if we want to talk about the very big lie, right at the top in my book is these people who have been killed by lockdown. Then at the other end of the scale is what we're doing to our children, which is something which is going to bear a very black fruit in the future. You know, there are already laws of studies coming out about the psychological damage being done to children who have been masked up and who are being subjected by the education profession to these terrible antisocial measures, which are ostensibly being imposed on them to protect their health from a disease from which they are statistically immune. So that's the other thing as well. We're building up a very, very dangerous backlog of damage to the mental health of the nation generally, but particularly our children. And then more broadly is the bigger transformations to our society, which these children are going to grow up being in a world which is going to be unrecognizable to the world that you and I grew up in.
In what way? Maybe tell me a little bit how our society is being reshaped. I'm asking again, very big question.
Yeah, it's a big question. You know, I could spend 10 hours kind of trying to answer that. Let's look at one thing. One of the things is, I think what's happening, what is definitely is in the process of happening or has happened, in one of the fundamental transformations that's happened in our society is our citizen status, our status as citizens within what has now become a biosecurity state. In a biosecurity state, you are guilty until proven innocent, instead of, as we are under at least principle, although Julian Assange would probably disagree with us, that you are in principle innocent until proven guilty. One of the fundamental things that's changed is that we are now considered as a de facto state of citizenship to be a danger to our fellow citizens. And we have to prove at all times and whenever it is demanded of us that we are not a threat to someone else. I think that's part of a kind of a longer cultural development that's been happening in liberal democracies for a long time. The culture of health and safety, the fear and paranoia has now toppled into something. And I can now be arrested if I don't prove to anyone, that could be anyone that a bouncer going into a club or a warden outside a football ground or simply walking along the street or someone at the door to a supermarket that I'm trying to enter. If they challenge me and say, are you vaccinated? Have you had a test? Are you COVID-free? Do you have a negative PCR test? Do you have a mask on? Blah, blah, blah. A whole range of biosecurity measures, which have very little relationship to any kind of medical reality, can now be demanded of me unless I meet those measures, whatever they are, and they're going to get more and more stringent. You know, the possibilities to them in the future are kind of limitless at the moment, unless I've got a smartphone which shows that I've just recently uploaded my health status, my biometric health status. All these things can be imposed on us. And unless I meet those, then my rights don't exist. My rights to move about the city, my rights to leave the country, my rights to enter a shop, my rights to look after my children, my rights to go to work, my rights to get on transport, all that has been taken away from me because I'm considered a priori as being a threat to my fellow citizens. It's an absolutely fundamental change in our status as citizens. And given that status, which is, it's kind of going forward in sort of fits and starts, you know, under lockdown, the full lockdown, that's exactly the world we were living in. It's kind of easing off now, but it's going to come back, you know, as soon as winter comes in again. And it's going to get worse and worse and worse and worse with the imposition of the digital monitoring and control of us. I mean, there's almost no limits to it. If they start imposing this on a sort of Chinese model of a social credit system. Our entire lives are going to be controlled. Given that, we can't say that we live in anything like a liberal democracy. Even the deeply compromised liberal democracies that we've been living in for the last sort of 40 years or something.
Mm. Yeah.
Am I upsetting you with my grim prospects?
No.
I mean, as I said to you before, I'm always a little bit reluctant to paint these apocalyptic scenarios of the future or the present. There's always, you know, things are never as homogeneous as those in power would like them to be. And I think it's very important to balance up these apocalyptic scenarios, which one gets sort of drawn into painting and to people, as you say to them, you know, please wake up. Why don't you see where we're going? Don't you see how dangerous this is? Don't you see what world your kids are going to be living in? Can't you see what damage this is doing? Can't you see, you know, and therefore you get drawn into painting these apocalyptic scenarios. And it's very important that we balance them up with an affirmation of our agency and what we can do to stop this, or at least to ameliorate it, and certainly not to bloody collaborate with it as well. One of the most appalling and kind of inexplicable aspects of what's been happening is the overwhelming lack of resistance to it and the willing collaboration of so many sectors of society and huge tranches of age groups. You know, over here, young kids, I don't mean children, I mean kind of like youth, are almost, you know, completely going along with this. And that shows, I think, to me that it's been culturally prepared by various cultural sort of strains which have preceded this. And which have prepared this new generation, who are then, you know, in 10, 20 years going to be running the world, to embrace these ideas without question. They don't have to be talked into this. They have been prepared for this for a very long time. And the lack of resistance, which only now, over here anyway, has been growing over the last sort of few months since the spring, has been one of the most inexplicable or confusing and depressing things about being in the middle of this. Whereas in the past, when we had these crises, which have been capitalized on by corporations, by governments, by so on and so forth, there's always been some form of resistance to it, some understanding of what's driving it, and, you know, maybe failed, maybe partially successful attempts to oppose it. And there's been so little of that. You know, there is complete cross-party consensus on this and collaboration. There is almost total media collaboration on this. And that's something which is very worrying. But once again, now I'm afraid I've gone back to a terrible scenario, haven't I? Very important for us to work out how we can oppose this, how we can challenge these orthodoxies, get people thinking, and importantly, get people acting as well.
I think that, and this is also something you write about, that a part of the problem is not only getting people to understand solutions, but also getting people to understand how they are part of the problem and the problem itself, because I think things have gotten so complex that it's a lot harder to understand how someone might be empowering some kind of apocalyptic future by getting a vaccine or putting on a mask than it is by sending their child off to war.
Yeah.
When we talk about this future that is dark, that I think we are signing up, building a prison, that's my own view. I think people hear us speak of some conspiracy that there are these elites that are planning something, and they almost shut off because it's too complicated for them to understand anything besides that. Or maybe it's something else, but I think most people hear us propose some kind of dramatic conspiracy, and that's where the conversation ends.
Yeah. I mean, we talked last time, didn't we, about the use of the accusation of conspiracy theory. It's a very powerful way of shutting people up. It's a way of saying what can and can't be said. And it feeds into an attitude of superior dismissiveness, which comforts people. If you sort of say to someone, here, read this, look at these figures, look at this, read this, try and understand this. Just look at one thing. Just look at, for instance, the fatality figures or the infection fatality rates, just some tiny little thing. Or look at this legislation. Do you think this legislation is really justified by what's going on? People don't want to do that. They don't want to do that for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of reasons behind that. We can speculate on those. There's a lot of weariness. There's a lot of distrust. Social media has obviously got a huge role in playing this. There's the kind of the delegitimation of figures of authority, people we believe. Nobody believes the government anymore. Nobody believes the media. Nobody believes corporations. Nobody believes anything, really. And you'd think that would make people question what's going on. But it's actually done the exact opposite. People don't know what to believe, so they believe authority. It's a strange sort of contradiction. And anyone who challenges authority is therefore a conspiracy theorist. But they're also so bored as well. I think they're just bored of thinking. They're bored of doubting. They're bored of not believing. And they want to believe in someone. They want to believe their government. They want to believe the corporations. They actually want to believe that the pharmaceutical companies, who have got one of the worst perceptions in the public opinion, have suddenly become people you're going to trust to pump their filthy drugs into our children. It's kind of incredible. And that's something that we need to understand if we're going to go back the long, long process, which possibly might be too late, of changing a lot of people's minds about what's going on. Fortunately, in the UK, it is beginning to happen.
That's pretty amazing. It's very demoralizing here. How can we import it?
Yeah, you said last time we chatted, and just go back over it. Yeah, I mean, in Europe, you know, there were these big protests, demonstrations, and just general reactions in Germany, in France, in Spain, you know, across Eastern Europe and so on. And in London, you know, in England, there was absolutely nothing. There was total acquiescence, you know, with the exception of a handful of kind of very brave souls who went out to Hyde Park and Speaker's Corner and all got arrested, but there was almost nothing at all. And now suddenly, the gates have kind of burst open a little bit. And since this spring, there is a growing reaction to this. There's something beyond that as well. Sorry to give you a little insight, but over in Europe at the moment, we're all glued to what's called the Euro 2020-21 football finals.
Okay.
I know this is kind of a bit archaic to you in the US, but we're kind of in the middle of this. And the British might stay at home for a year and not go out because the government tells them if they do, they'll die. But when it comes to football, you know, there are some things which are sacred. And in this country, football is sacred. And there have been huge numbers of crowds kind of getting together on the streets, hugging each other and so on. And basically, there's been very public demonstrations outside of the actual anti-lockdown demonstrations and the anti-vaccine demonstrations, or people who probably don't give a damn about these sort of political issues, but who quite clearly don't believe that we're facing this terrible threat and don't believe that masks, social distancing, at least, and perhaps vaccination, I don't know, maybe they've got vaccines, are required in order to go out into the world again. So even beyond the more explicit political demonstrations, oppositions and non-compliance, the civil disobedience to this, there is also a kind of a more general, I think, growing demonstration amongst the people of Britain that we're just not believing this rubbish anymore.
You know, for us, everything is open. Bruce Springsteen had a concert and we had the Pride Parade this weekend and it was full on Pride Parade with all the ensuing color on the train. And for here, it unfortunately doesn't mean people are actually defying anything because they've now ordered people to go out and have a good summer, you know?
Yeah.
So the public is convinced that now it's okay. And when they'll be told to go inside again, they're just going to, they haven't reckoned with a need to ignore these tremendously infantilizing rules that are constantly telling people how to move, how to live, how to, you know, think about their bodies.
I'm sorry to use the football kind of example again, but when I was on the march, we had another of these giant marches last Saturday.
Was it good?
Yeah, it was great. It was enormous.
You didn't
huge.
Post pictures, though.
No, I didn't this time. I was enjoying myself too much to take photos. You know, when you take photos, you become a kind of a spectator rather than a participant.
Yeah.
You know, the last one, I kind of said, okay, I'm going to take photos, but, you know, I wanted to sort of join in. And at one point, we passed through Trafalgar Square. I don't know if you know it, but Trafalgar Square is the kind of the big central square in London. It's got Nelson's Column in it, and it's the kind of a place where people tend to meet up and protest. It's close to Whitehall and Downing Street, and the kind of the centre of government and the civil service. And the entire square had been fenced off with high metal fences and surrounded by security. But this wasn't to stop the protest going into the square. It was so that people could go into what's called a Eurozone and watch the football there. Now, I'm not even sure they have to pay to go in. I'm not sure it's actually a money-making thing. It's a control thing. When you go in, I don't know because I didn't go in myself and I didn't speak to the security guys, but they look pretty aggressive. I don't know whether you had to show any proof of vaccination or of your, you know, having a negative test or something like that. But inside, the tables were all socially distanced. I think in some places they actually have little kind of pig pens, sort of fences with kind of like little groups where kind of four people belonging to a kind of a unit can sit together or stand together and then watch the sport, the game, on a big screen. And I thought, that's kind of an image of our future. And it might seem quite benign, but of course, all they have to do is suddenly go, okay, you can't come in here until you've got a negative PCR test, or you can't come in here until you've shown that you've uploaded your biometric status onto, you know, a centralized or privatized kind of a database, and you can't come in, or you have to be vaccinated, you have to have your vaccine every 6 months or something like this. These are easy things to impose on then your access. But then the other thing I thought was strange was, this is a public square. It's the place where people always go in London where there's a big event on, whether it's a protest or whether it's a celebratory thing. And they had privatized it. They had fenced it off from the public. And the people inside, I'm not sure you actually do have to pay to get in, but of course, you're not allowed to take anything in there. So everything you buy in there, whether it's a beer or a drink or food, is being sold at enormously high prices. So the corporate sponsors of it have got complete control over you, who gets in and what you do when you're in there. But the other thing I thought was strange was, this is a public square. It's where people come to meet each other. And yet they were going there to the central public space in London to watch something that wasn't happening there. They were there to watch a screen of a football match going on somewhere else. And I thought this was a great, horrible, but very suggestive image of community in the future in this biosecurity state. There's a kind of a residual longing within us as humans to meet our fellow human beings. And they were going to completely control this. But the thing is, we weren't getting together to talk to each other. We're getting together to watch a digital recording of what some other person was doing somewhere else. It seemed a kind of a perverse, dystopian vision of what a fully digitalized society is. A system, a society in which your access to public space is completely controlled according to biosecurity requirements, in which you have to prove again that you do not present a threat, that you are obedient, that you are compliant with whatever the regulations are required of you. But then the actual experience itself, the experience of community, of meeting each other, had then been digitalized. It had then become taken away from you. People weren't in there. They weren't even able to mix in there because they're in these separated, socially distanced pens. But they weren't there to see each other. They weren't there to act. They weren't there to exert their agency. They weren't there to protest or to celebrate or to dance or whatever it is. They weren't even there to eat. They were there to watch a spectacle, a corporate spectacle, which was being televised on a big screen in front of them. And that's, I don't know, maybe some people think, what's wrong with that? But to me, it gave me kind of real chills about when the spectacle is completely controlled by the corporations control the movements of the people as well. And that's a form of government that goes way beyond the usual instruments of government, like the police or the law or the economy or something. It goes into this term, biosecurity. It's about technologies of controlling the bodies of the population. And that's what biosecurity is about. When you control the body of the subject, of the citizen, you erase their rights. They have no rights. They only have access. They only have access or refused access. And they have to do everything you say to be able to participate in this spectacle, you know, which we are one day going to call community. Again, this has been going on a long time. The kind of the corporatization and digitalization of sport has been going on for a long time. But in our kind of enormously fragmented society, these moments of community, when we do come together en masse, if you control those, you control people. If you control the bodies of the people, you control their subjectivity, you control their citizenship. We don't really have a citizenship anymore. We only have a bio status in a way. So I looked at that, and you know, the kind of the security around it was immense. It looked like a crash site or something like that. Huge guys, you know, dressed up in guns and all this sort of stuff. And it was to stop people going in or out of a football match or a televised football match. And yet, of course, the place was full. The place was full because everyone was like, yeah, this is, you know, I'm dying to have some sense of community after being locked down for 15 months. They're dying. They'd do anything to get into there. And that's going to be the sort of the carrot and stick which is being used to completely control us. And it's become so transparent now that I imagine a lot of people, if they listen to this, will go, hey, Simon, what's wrong with that? You know, just let the people watch the match. But that's what's scary. That's what's scary, that maybe you and I look at that and think, oh, dear. You know, kind of look at what this is actually going to mean. When, you know, this is just a spectacle. It's a cultural spectacle. When this is used for much bigger things, like, for instance, the people who are protesting against something, and they start using the same technologies, the same regulations, the same programs of control, of monitoring and surveillance, which the police are already using. You know, they kettle us, and they say you can only get out the kettle if you give us all your details. One day it's going to be, unless you give us your biometric data. And that means you don't do anything. You don't go anywhere. You don't go to work. You don't get on public transport. You don't leave the country. You possibly don't even see your kids or your family unless you show that you are obedient to what the police and the government and the state has told you. And it's a very fine line between controlling a football match, watching people watching a football match, and controlling any form of dissent to the state and the government running it. And that's kind of where I think we are now, and why I'm kind of scared of it.
Yeah, we're back to...
we're back in the apocalyptic, aren't we?
Well, the thing is that a lot of people don't think this is apocalyptic. They think that sounds so great. Life will be a series of upgrades, and there's a gamification element. It makes life maybe transcribed and manageable.
Yeah, maybe it's micromanagements of their kind of people's mental state and stuff. There's a deeply religious element to this. That philosopher that I've been reading a lot of, Giorgio Agamben, the Italian philosopher of biopolitics and biopower. You know, he's been writing a kind of a blog about the coronavirus crisis since it began in Italy. He lives in Italy. And Italy was one of the first countries to be really sort of badly hit by this and the reactions to it and so on. And he started a blog in which he has these sort of short entries. And he's kind of been the most important philosopher about biopolitics and biopower for the last 25 years. So, of course, as soon as this happens and kind of proves everything he's been saying and everything he's predicting right, you know, in big black and white on a billboard, he started getting denounced and attacked and attempts to silence him and, you know, called a murderer or someone who's endangering the people or just a dodgy old man who's lost the plot and all this sort of stuff, not just by the kind of the gutter press, which is a tautology because all the press is gutter, but you know, by philosophers, by philosophy students. He was kind of completely slaughtered, but to his credit, he's gone on. He knows his stuff. He's an extraordinary philosopher and thinker. But in one of his later commentaries on this, he started talking about cultic practice as the responses, the biosecurity measures, wearing masks, washing hands in disinfectant, social distancing, all these kind of practices which have absolutely no basis whatsoever in medicine. You know, before the governments got together and decided, okay, this is what we're going to do, both in the UK and the US, who's your head honcho there, Fauci, you know, they all said basically asymptomatic transmission really doesn't exist and it's never been a driver of pandemics in the past. Now suddenly it's the primary, you know, it's the whole basis of this. You know, all our chief medical officers over here say no, masks are absolutely useless. They do absolutely nothing at all except terrify people and perhaps damage, stop your breathing, you know, blah, blah, blah. Suddenly it all got changed around. Everyone knows, anyone who thinks and reads and remembers further than a few months back, knows is that these practices do not have any medical basis and are, if anything, harmful physically, medically, but certainly socially and politically. They do immense because they are a demonstration of compliance and of collaboration and of kind of, you know, a unity, you know, we're all in this together sort of stuff. And he, to try and understand why they had been embraced so almost universally, and unquestioningly, the Agamben kind of developed this idea that they were cultic practices. That is, practices which have no affectivity. I don't know if you're an atheist or not, but, you know, some of us believe that praying to your God doesn't actually have an effect. It might have a good effect on you, but it doesn't actually do something. Or crossing yourself when you go into a church, or if you go into a synagogue, or if you go into, you know, wherever your religious place, and the kind of the various practices around that, confession, you know, whatever and so on. And he started comparing these various practices to religious practices. And he said they're cultic practices. They're done because they make you feel safe. They make you feel that you're part of a community of belief. That they kind of, what you said before, they're kind of a way of managing your mental health, managing your psychology as you go through the day, you face traumas or threats or so on and so forth. But what they do not have, and you know, I'm not saying necessarily these are all bad things, but they are bad if they create compliance to tyranny, and that's what they're doing at the moment. That is bad. That's absolutely bad. There's no two ways about it. Anyone who puts a mask on, who gets a vaccine, who washes their hands, who practices social distancing, who uploads their biometric data, who does all that sort of stuff, is contributing to collusion with tyranny. But his idea was to try and understand why they've been embraced so quickly. How is it that suddenly every other value that we have, primary amongst which is profit. You know, capitalism is our religion and profit is the key value in our world. If something makes profit, it has value. Doesn't matter how beautiful it is or whatever, if it doesn't make profit, it's not, it doesn't have any value. That's the kind of, in very simple terms, in our world. Suddenly, that primary value of capitalism, if it makes money, it's worth something, has been overthrown to a certain extent. It was for a while, when suddenly it seemed that all the businesses were ready to suspend commerce for months on end. You know, the government, which has always said it hasn't got any money, was suddenly putting everyone on furlough and spending billions of pounds to keep people out of work. All this kind of complete inversion of the values of capitalism. What we know now is that's not at all what's happened. The money for furlough, we're going to be paying off, and our children and children are going to be paying this off forever, and it's going to lead to an enormous cut in public spending. And certainly small businesses, medium-sized businesses, and various industries like the entertainment industry, the retail industry, have been, you know, almost destroyed by this, enormously damaged, with millions of small businesses going out of business. You know, our own one has kind of really sort of suffered in this, and we managed to keep our heads up. But the corporations, the big corporations, have got more and more powerful and made more and more money. I think in 2020, I think there's something like 2,200, and I used to have these figures off the top of my head, 2,200 billionaires in the world, and their wealth grew at a greater rate, it increased, more than at any time in the history of the world. So what ostensibly sort of was seen as, you know, some people have said, oh, this is an overthrow of capitalism, that's ludicrous, it's factually wrong. It's not. This is an expansion of the control of capitalism. This is about a revolution in capitalism which has expanded its power, its monopoly, because I happen to believe that capitalism is not, and hasn't been for a very long time, if it ever was, I suppose it was, is not about competition, creating quality. It's about monopolization, which is why the world is run by a fewer and fewer number of people and smaller number of bigger and bigger corporations. And that has increased massively through this crisis and under lockdown. Corporations have got more power, and now they don't just want all the money in the world, they actually want to run the bloody world as well.
I think a lot of people have a very hard time understanding anything but what they see immediately, which is that the place makes money because the drinks are overpriced and the snacks are overpriced, and therefore the place must want more people to come in. And why would they keep people from coming in if that would be a loss of them? Why would they stop people who don't have their documents or who don't have the right app? People will say, don't worry, there won't be a biosecurity state because businesses won't want to bother.
Yeah. The most powerful corporations in the world, they're only going for market share. We can't have exponential increase in productivity. Production is going to fall. We're running out of resources, and the ability of the world to keep on buying more stuff, our consumption, our ability to consume, particularly in the West, is going down. I don't think these immense corporations are merely about turning a profit or increasing their already immense profits. You know, the kind of money that they're investing in, what do they call it? Social investment, isn't it? It's about control. It's about control of people. It's about getting access to our data and therefore being able to control us. You know, when people look at Bill Gates, you know, our kind of pantomime villain, although there's nothing funny about him, when they say, wow, you know, the guy's, you know, putting all his money into, you know, in vaccines, isn't that a great thing? But, you know, we're seeing now how his vaccination program in places like Africa, which, you know, he's been held up as, you know, one of the world's great philanthropists for that. We're seeing that there's a very, very different kind of program behind that, which is not about turning a profit on selling vaccines, you know, to billions of people in Africa. It's about other things as well. It's about controlling people. It's about getting access to land. It's about getting access to the resources that Africa has, which is, you know, one of the big sort of battlegrounds of the world's economies at the moment, to get into that world. It has been for many years, to get into that place and get as many resources as they can out of it. And these are all ways in which you can, you know, social investment in populations is not a new thing, but it's increased massively. And again, it kind of goes back to that idea of biosecurity. We no longer have right to health. We have an obligation to the biosecurity of a population or a state or a country or a city or whatever. And once you set that up as a paradigm of citizenship, you've fundamentally changed the way that we're governed. And the governing, what we call our governments, are merely the legal and enforcement administrative bodies which are actually implementing the interests of the corporations who, you know, the biggest corporations in the world are far more powerful, far wealthier, certainly, and becoming as powerful as almost every country in the world, except the very biggest ones. You know, we haven't really talked about people like our old friend Klaus Schwab, you know, but, you know, he really is kind of a pantomime villain. But, you know, he says very openly in his books that, you know, we want to have a new form of governance. It's actually nothing new about it. It's about the collaboration, the collusion. I would actually say it's more about, it's not actually a collaboration between public and private or between government and corporation. It's about the erasure of the distinction between them. We still have this model. We still have a residual model of democratic governance, which is based around things like elections, the law courts, the police, the fifth estate, media, and all this sort of stuff. These are rapidly becoming residual ideological forms whose new function within a kind of a global biosecurity state is to implement with the authority that they've had because of the history that they've had in these liberal democracies, to implement the interests of enormously, immensely powerful corporations in their struggle for the resources of the world. And that seems to be what's going on at the moment. I think it's clearly what's going on at the moment. But again, we were talking about how to get people to kind of engage with this. You know, that sentence alone kind of sounded ludicrous in my own ears. You know, maybe we should try and talk about, why don't I ask you a question? There are more people who are realizing within their own way, because one of the things that has come out of, which I find very interesting, is that people from completely different, let's call it in the bigger terms, political beliefs or commitments or backgrounds or whatever you want to call it, people who usually would not even sit in the same park bench are now holding hands and marching down the street together, you know, figuratively and literally. I think that offers real hope. How do you think, I know you're saying it's a bit different in the US because maybe you haven't had this sort of uprising, as it were, or this demonstration of that happening. Because I'm sure in the US, I've lived in the US, I'm sure not everyone believes in this. How do we turn that into change? Let's call it social change, political change. How do we do that?
Well, yeah, yeah.
That's a question for you, Frieda.
You also ask hard ones. You know, the US, we do have the problem that much of the opposition is very party line. We have a very polarized population. In New York City, where I am, everyone is very afraid to go against the trend. And in other places, it would be very focused on making fun of the lunacy of the people in these liberal enclaves, which rightfully so. They deserve scorn because their children are walking around in 90-degree humid heat with masks.
Yeah.
So we're really struggling with finding a way to be a voice of change instead of just more self-righteous anger.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I feel very strongly that there is a lack of an awareness. That's been my feeling, and maybe it's more so in the US, of the emotional devastation that would come if we allow ourselves to be okay with where we're going. So yeah. I guess I come around to more raising awareness, which I'm sure a lot of people will think is very futile and too elementary, but I don't see that that's been done enough. I do hear it in the UK because I'm in a group that's predominantly UK, and I found that there is a lot more in that group. I don't know that it's reflecting the general population, but
are you talking about online groups?
An online group. Yeah.
Do you have any physical groups? You're in Brooklyn, aren't you? Do you have any physical groups to meet up with and kind of share your thinking about this?
A little bit, not much, a little bit. Yeah. I made a friend with whom I go stickering. You know, we put up rose stickers.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, the attitude will be, I don't have time for this shit. That's what people will say.
That's another excuse for apathy, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
I hear this so often, you know, this year when everyone's sitting at home doing nothing for a year, and they're like, I don't have time to read your stuff. It's like, yeah, right. It's like you've never had more time on your hand. But I don't have time to read this, you know. Yeah. It's like the accusation of conspiracy theory. It's like, I don't have time to think about this. I don't want to talk to, so I'm just going to dismiss you.
It's kind of laziness.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. You know, you and I and, you know, people who are kind of fighting this, you know, we spend a lot of time trying to, you know, to use that phrase, raise awareness or whatever, just get information out there, you know? There's a lot of awareness and a lot of people looking for something, but it's very hard. But I don't think it's totally futile because the other night we met up with a lawyer, a barrister, Francis Hall, Francis Hoare, who's been a real kind of champion of those oppressed by the COVID faithful and more over in the UK, a great guy. And we got into some trouble and he helped us out. So to celebrate, we took him out to a pub, which I will not name, which you don't have to do any of the kind of the stupidity. And we went out and had a few beers and stuff. And we talked a lot about this. And one of the things we shared was our amazement at how so many people we know, friends, colleagues, you know, just general, who would describe themselves as whether they're socialists or liberal or whatever, just, you know, people who are suspicious of government, who can see through lies of media, who think human rights are important, who defend their freedom, who care about their kids, who want to have some sort of economic independence from the state, all these kind of, you know, a whole range of coalescing kind of ideas that you might call as characteristic of a liberal democracy or the people who live in it, have suddenly just given it all up. They've suddenly refused to think and stuff. And I was kind of saying, and I think we kind of agreed on this, that there has been a preparation for this. This isn't just not a top-down thing. This hasn't been imposed upon us by the government. It hasn't been enforced upon us by the police. It hasn't been lied to us by the media. All that's true, and it's been the enforcement, the legislation, and the lies have been to a degree which I've never seen before in my life, ever. But the reason it's been so successful is because we've embraced it as a people. We've embraced this. And it's kind of, I hope it's not too late, but a lot of people have embraced this. They wanted to do it. And that shows that the cultural, I think in the West, we've got a carefully manufactured, inaccurate perception of what a dictatorship is. And the kind of the primary model of that is this enormous industry of films about the Third Reich or Nazi Germany or whatever. I mean, in the UK, not a week goes by and there's not a program on the TV about Nazi Germany, some aspect of it. I mean, there's a lot to talk about, but it's on all the time. And I've always wondered about it. And it paints a very inaccurate image of what a dictatorship is. And of course, there's other ones that we use as well, but that's the kind of the primary one. And it's of an oppressed people, people who are terrified, who are always being watched by whoever it is, by the police, by the military, and so on and so forth. And of course, that was present. But dictatorships don't work unless the people believe in the dictators. They just don't work. When, after the collapse, the fall of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and suddenly you had all these countries behind the Iron Curtain who in a matter of months, suddenly people got out in the street and it was all, boom, it's all over. People believe in dictatorships, and that's why they happen. Dictatorships, no matter how strong your military, how big your police force, and in the UK, we've got an immense police force. In London, we've got 50,000 plus coppers telling us what to do all the time, and they're all over the streets at the moment. But it doesn't work unless people embrace it. This is why I'm really against this conspiracy theory of history, this idea that there are these immensely powerful people who are controlling us, and you've got the government and the police and the military. That's not the way societies work. People have to believe in dictatorship. They have to want it. And what this crisis has shown is that people do want dictatorship. They don't call it that, but they do want it because they've embraced this. And they're willing now to sacrifice everything which is the opposite of dictatorship for a little bit of safety, a little bit of peace of mind, for the ability to go back and make a living and all that sort of stuff. That means that the cultural sphere, the social sphere of what we're trying to do to challenge this, to get information out, to raise awareness, to encourage people to civil disobedience, to get out there and protest, to not be afraid, is an important thing. If you believe that, well, it doesn't matter, you can't fight the police, you can't fight the government, you can't fight the corporations, that's what they want us to believe. And it isn't true. Historically, I'm a historian, that's not the way dictatorships work. They work as people embrace, they want a dictatorship. It seems kind of crazy, but it's true. And the thing is, it's been proven true because the majority of people in liberal democracies in the West, Western capitalism, have embraced this. They want dictatorship. And we can, you know, speculate about the cultural, social, and political, economic causes of that. It doesn't really matter at the moment. It matters to analysis. Point is, how we can challenge that. So what I'm trying to say is the things that we're trying to do, this podcast, to try to get people to start thinking, to start acting, to start being brave, to start talking to their friends, to not be scared of the police and the government and the media and the corporations, to not be scared that they're never going to work again, all that. It is important what we're doing, and we will win if we all stand up and say no. Civil disobedience. Dictatorship only works with compliance. So, yeah, I'd say, you know, what we're doing is important, and it's the only thing we've got, because they've got everything else against us. They've got the media, they've got the army, they've got the police, they've got the education, they've got the teachers, they've got the tech companies, they've got the corporations, they've got the money, they've got the parliamentary system, they've got the political parties, they've got everything. But what we've got is the people.
Yeah.
It's been brilliant to see in excess of 1 million people marching. It's not even really a march through London when these demonstrations happen. It's just an occupation of London. It's not really a march. There's so many people. It's just London is full of these people all breaking the law. And it's wonderful to see. And that could go anywhere. That can go absolutely anywhere. When dictatorships fall, it happens like that. It's got to happen. Because otherwise, yeah, we'll go back to all those terrifying scenarios that we painted earlier on. But they're not certain. Nothing is certain. And the extent of the lie, this lie is so big, it's so ludicrous, that it wouldn't take enormous amount for that lie to be exposed.
Yeah. You answered your own question beautifully.
I think we both did. We both did.
Yeah. It was a team effort. Yeah, and you're leaving us on a more positive note. I do actually believe that, because I do believe there's only so much we can repress our own psyches, you know, before we start to realize that the price is very high.
There was this wonderful interview with Peter Ustinov. Do you know him, the actor? He's an actor sort of 50s and 60s and things. And he was the kind of guy involved in UN and charity work and stuff like that. And this was back in, I think the interview was back in the late 70s, maybe. And he was being interviewed. And the world was in a lot better place then when it is now. But he said, do you believe what you're doing is going to do anything? It's the question that we get asked all the time. What's the point? Do you really think you're doing anything? And he said, pessimism is an indulgence which we cannot afford to have anymore. He says, the pessimist is the man who wakes up every morning and discovers the world is full of bad people. Whereas the optimist wakes up every morning, knows the world is a bad place, and does everything he or she can do to make it a better place. That sounds like gooey sort of liberal stuff, but I'm definitely not a liberal. I believe in social practice. We can't be pessimists. We can't. We've got to be optimist. But the optimist means acting towards an end which we know has got to happen. We've got to be optimist because it's all we've got. We've got to do that. And I think a growing number of people, certainly in this country, are aware of that. They're coming for our kids with their needles and all their terrible antisocial oppression of this new generation, and it's up to us to stand up to them.
Yeah. We try. We try. Well, I'm going to let you go. I have a whole list of questions that I'm not going to ask you. I'm going to ask you next time.
Next time, Frieda.
No.
Tell you what, we'll do this again in 6 months, just before Christmas. We're in the dark of winter. And see if any of our predictions came true. And see, we'll have a catch up on the state of the world then, eh?
Yes, I'm going to be in touch.
Okay.
All right, have a good night.
See you, Frieda. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Radically Human with me, Frieda Wiesel. I want to say a big thank you to Simon Elmer, as well as all the other wonderful folks who agreed to be on my podcast as guests, as well as all of you who were listening and engaging in conversations that were often taboo and we were told we were not allowed to have. I appreciate the support we've been giving each other, as well as the openness to talk about what I think are very important and timely topics. Here's to hoping we see some progress and a very powerful fight in 2022. Happy New Year.